We'll hear arguments first this morning in number 1236, Carson and Others Against American Brands, Incorporated. Mr. Williams, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This case is here on a writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. The issue presented for decision in this case arises in the context of an employment discrimination suit commenced under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 42 U.S.C. 1981. It is a case of first impression for the Court. The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, sitting en banc with Circuit Judge Hull writing the opinion for the majority, held in the decision of that court that the petitioners could not appeal an order of the district court below which rejected the party's jointly proposed consent decree on the grounds that the injunctive provisions of that decree were in violation of Title VII and on the ground that the enforcement of those provisions would violate the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States.
Mr. Williams, I get some impression from the papers that the respondent may have a different view about going ahead with the consent decree. Whenever you wish, would you comment on whether that is the fact, if you know, and if so, are they free to withdraw? And, of course, your friend will tell us something about that, too, perhaps.
Your Honor, we do not think that they are free to withdraw. We think that is a matter of contractual obligation. They made a motion in the district court. That court has stayed all further considerations of this matter until a decision by this court. Your Honor, Chief Judge Hainsworth and Circuit Judge Winter and Bussner dissented. They believe that the order of the district court was appealable under Section 1292A1 as an interlocutory order denying an injunction. The petitioners believe that the Fourth Circuit made an error in holding that this order could not be immediately appealable. In our brief, petitioners presented two arguments in support of the appealability of the district court order. First, we believe that the order is appealable as an order denying an injunction under Section 1292A1. Secondly, we believe that it is appealable under the collateral order exception that this court announced with regards to Section 1291 in Cohen versus Beneficial Industrial Loan Company. Before I present my argument on these two...
Do you feel that it qualifies under both sections?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Do you feel there's any inconsistency between in that position?
No, I do not, Your Honor, for the simple reason that this is a case where the order said so many things that it had the effect of deciding some things on the merits and some things that were collateral to the merits.
In any event, you would be willing to win on either.
Yes, Your Honor, I certainly would.
Did you argue that Cohen's a matter in the Court of Appeals?
The matter was presented to the Court of Appeals, Your Honor. Also, if Your Honor would take a look at the decision by the Fourth Circuit below, it's quite clear that one of the decisions that the Fourth Circuit thought was dispositive of the matter was the Second Circuit decision in Siegel versus Merritt, which was decided entirely under Section 1291. Your Honor, let me give you some of the background to this case.
Before you do that, counsel, since, as I understand the Cohen doctrine, it has to be not related to the merits. If you were successful in appealing this order under the Cohen doctrine, could you appeal that part that related to the merits too?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's quite clear from the decisions of this court that once an appellate court has jurisdiction, by virtue of the ancillary jurisdiction that the court has, it can then reach out and decide all other issues in the case that require reversal. Your Honor, this suit concerns employment discrimination in the tobacco industry. This is an industry which has had a long history of official segregation and discrimination with respect to blacks. The parties reached a proposed consent order in this case. This is an order, Your Honor, which was reached after long discussions and after extensive discovery. It was a matter that was reached after the parties were quite aware, in part because of the discovery, of the basic strengths and weaknesses of their case. The heart of the consent decree was contained in a series of provisions which enjoined the employer and the unions from further discriminating against the plaintiffs. Moreover, that consent decree had provisions which required the employer and the unions to take remedial actions with respect to changing the seniority and the transfer rules so that those rules would no further discriminate against seasonal workers. In common with other consent decrees, Your Honor, that settlement also had an exculpatory clause whereby the respondents could suffer the entry of a judgment against them without admitting liability. Because this action was a class action, it was necessary to get approval of the district court under Rule 23E of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The parties, by virtue of this rule, went to the district court. Now, at this point, and for the first time, Your Honor, the parties found themselves at loggerhead with the district court over the question of the legality of the proposed settlement. The district court, by virtue of its powers under Rule 23E, decided that the proposed consent decree, with respect to those injunctive provisions to which I referred a moment ago, was unlawful because those provisions, it said, violated Title VII, and the enforcement of those provisions by a federal court, it said, would be arbitrary and capricious actions which would violate the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Petitioners sought review of that determination in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, however, decided that it was not appealable. They said it was not appealable because that decision by the district court was simply what it deemed a step toward trial. That court did not deem the matter to be a decision of the district court which passed on the merits of the action commenced by the plaintiff. That was rather surprising, Your Honor, since that same court also said that it was not appealable, no matter what the reasons were for the district court refusing the injunctive decree. Now, let me give you some of the reasons for refusing that decree, which were stated by the district court in the opinion that accompanied its order. First, the district court said that preferential treatment on the basis of race was unlawful, except in those cases where the defendants had themselves committed discrimination against those persons who were part of the plaintiff's class. Secondly, it said that since all of the seasonal workers were black, any relief that was given to seasonal workers would in effect be preferential treatment based upon race and therefore barred again by the Fifth Amendment and also by Title VII.
Third, Mr. Williams, yes. The merits aren't before us, are they?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Just the appealability of whether the district court was right or wrong in what he said about the propriety of the decree.
That's correct, Your Honor. The only reason for going into the merits at all is so that this court can make a preliminary assessment as to whether or not, with respect to the argument under Section 1292A, the merits were touched upon by the decree, and also to see if the collateral interests, which the petitioners claim were adversely affected, were separate and apart from those merits.
Had you asked for a preliminary injunction?
Your Honor, we had not asked for a preliminary injunction, and in view of the determination made by the district court, it is quite clear that a preliminary injunction would not and could not have been granted, because that court found that there were no vestiges of discrimination to be corrected or remedied. And given the fact that it is necessary with respect to a preliminary injunction to establish that you have a prima facie case or that you have a substantial chance of prevailing on the merits, it was clear to the petitioners, and I think it would have been clear to the district court as well, that that burden could not have been met by petitioners.
Would you say that a denial of a temporary restraining order was appealable?
A denial of a temporary restraining order.
So that you asked for ex parte pending a hearing on a request for a preliminary injunction?
No, we did not, Your Honor. But with respect to denial of a temporary restraining order, I think the law is quite clear that that is not appealable under Section 1292A1, although the denial of a preliminary injunction is, of course, appealable. The one further thing which the district court said, and I think I basically mentioned this before, Your Honor, is that despite the long history of segregation and discrimination which had existed in the tobacco industry, that there were no vestiges of discrimination to be overcome. Now, as I tried to indicate before to Your Honors, petitioners have two arguments which they wish to present to this court, one based on Section 1292A1 and one based on the collateral order doctrine. Common to these arguments are certain policy considerations which I think must be kept in mind as you make a determination as to whether or not this order was appealable. The first point which I want to emphasize is that there comes a time in every lawsuit when the parties have to make a basic decision as to whether or not this is a case which will be settled or a case which will be litigated. Petitioners believe that sound judicial administration requires that artificial barriers not be put in the place of parties attempting to reach settlement in the case. Whether a settlement can be reached in any case, Your Honors, is a function of many factors. One factor that the parties will always consider is the expense of further litigation, especially the expense of further litigation in relationship to the expenses which have already been incurred. Another factor, and this is a factor we think, Your Honor, which is quite important in racial discrimination cases and in labor management cases, and that is the desirability which the parties have to keep down forces of civil strife in the workplace. We think, Your Honor, that this is one of the reasons why the Congress of the United States has endorsed the idea that voluntary settlement and cooperation should be preferred means of resolving racial discrimination cases brought under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. A third factor which affects settlement possibilities will be the parties' assessment of their chances of winning or losing the lawsuit. Now, this is an assessment, Your Honor, which will, of course, depend upon the time. The further the lawsuit progresses, the more likely the parties would tend to reach a different assessment as to their chances of prevailing, and therefore the terms of a settlement would vary with the progress of time. Therefore, Your Honor, in a case like this, if the parties are denied the settlement that they themselves won and are forced to litigate further, then the parties are being put in a position whereby they may never be able to retrieve the opportunity which they once had.
Which way, Mr. Williams, do you think negative aspects of piecemeal appeals cuts in this case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, in light of your past decisions, it is quite clear that one of the reasons why this Court has decided that piecemeal adjudication is bad is because of the expense and the time that it consumes, and also the cost to the parties and the Court and the public interest as a whole. Now, here, one of the factors we're considering is the question of cost and the question of time and expense. So in this particular instance, Your Honor, I think that where you have parties who do not themselves want to litigate and who are trying not to litigate, that to give them the opportunity not to litigate is the policy that best furthers the policies behind the avoidance of piecemeal litigation. If in a case like this, where the district court erects a legal barrier to the party's ability to settle the case, that matter should be reviewed, we believe, by an appellate court so that the parties can determine if they can or should not go further.
I suppose part of your argument is that if you allow an appeal, you avoid piecemeal litigation, because if the appeal comes out a certain way, the case is over.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is exactly the case here. If an appeal were allowed, and if this case were decided favorably to the petitioner, that would be an end to this litigation. any other course we think will result in litigation for at least the next 2 or 3 years.
Is it not generally true that on the problem of piecemeal appeals, that one of the propositions is that if it comes out one way, it will terminate the litigation, and if it comes out the other way, it does not? Isn't that always true?
Well, Your Honor, the only thing that the parties would have suffered in that particular case would have been a certain amount of delay if it comes out adversely, in this case, for example, to petitioners. But here you have parties who have been willing, certainly up until now, to settle their claim, so that if it were determined that the district court was wrong in its ascertainment of the legal principles that govern decision in this case, then that would help to, that would have helped the parties to have resolved this matter prior to the matter coming to this court.
But you're making a Cohen's, more of a Cohen's argument now than anything, I take it, and that this kind of an argument would lead you to say that any denial of a motion for summary judgment would be appealable.
No.
But if that denial is reversed, the case is over.
No, we don't think the argument leads to that conclusion, Your Honor. We think for the reason that was indicated in Goldstein versus Cox. Goldstein points out that your decision in Switzerland Cheese was not an order denying an injunction because the decision on that case turned upon an assessment of the facts, not on a determination of the legal principles. Where a motion for summary judgment is made and it is denied as a matter of law, then Goldstein versus Cox makes it clear that that is, for this court, an open question. But also, Your Honor, in this particular case, it's clear that the order of the district court reached the merits. Your Honor, I would like to reserve for further discussion 5 minutes of rebuttal time. My white light is on. My time is concluded. Thank you.
Could I ask you one question, Mr. Wendy?
Yes, Your Honor.
What if the district court had said there is now pending in the Fourth Circuit a case which will decide the legality of this consent order, and I think it will be decided in about 3 or 4 months, so I'm going to withhold my consent until the Fourth Circuit hands down its opinion. Would you say that that sort of a refusal to enter the consent decree by the district court made allowed you to appeal?
That would not be appealable, Your Honor. That would simply be a step toward further litigation of the case, and also it would not pass on the merits of the case. Thank you.
Mr. Dalton.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. More often than not, Title VII suits brought by the government end up in consent decrees, thus encouraging voluntary compliance and maximizing limited federal law enforcement resources. Indeed, before even commencing lawsuits, the Justice Department typically contacts potential defendants and invites them to sit down and discuss settlement, and advises them that should settlement be reached, that agreement must be memorialized in a consent decree. Thus, to the extent that the government is forced to try cases, which but for the district court's unreasoned objection would result in a settlement that's fair to the defendants and that advances the rights of agreed parties, our ability to vigorously enforce Title VII and related statutes is seriously undermined. Now, we submit that the order appealed from is appealed both as an order refusing an injunction and as a collateral order.
Mr. Dalton, you don't suggest that EEOC or Title VII actions are governed by different rules of appealability than are set forth in 1291 or 1292?
No, not at all. We are not asking for a special rule relating to Title VII, but our peculiar interest in the case results from our experience under Title VII.
Mr. Dalton?
Yes.
Before you proceed, would you state precisely the elements of the injunction as you perceive them, the injunction that was denied?
My understanding is that there's a general element of prohibiting discrimination in the future. That there were
prohibiting
certain,
what?
Again, please?
Prohibiting discrimination?
Yes.
Right.
That there are mandatory features of the injunction, for example, the requirement that hereinafter, blacks be hired into supervisory positions, help me on this, until they, until one-third of the supervisors are blacks.
Well, I can ask Mr. Williams when he
yes.
when he resumes his argument.
Thank you. I can do it, but it's going to stretch me a bit. Common to all appealability theories, in our view, is the question of whether or not the order at issue is reviewable following final judgment. As my brother, Mr. Williams, indicated, settlements are based upon the party's assessment of the strengths and weaknesses of their own cases, their assessment of the facts that the court is likely to find credible. After the evidence is in, those perceptions change. Indeed, they're replaced by knowledge of the strengths and weaknesses of cases, of the parties' respective cases, by knowledge of what aspects of your own, what vulnerabilities in your own case have managed to escape detection. And once the final judgment is in, as a practical matter, the Court of Appeals can never return to the state of facts or perceptions that existed at the time a consent decree was entered into. Because if the litigated judgment is not defective for reasons unto it, in order to return to the settlement proposal that arguably was improperly rejected by the district court, the Court of Appeals would, in essence, have to base its reversal on facts other than those proved at trial. And on merits other than those as they appear following a fully litigated case. Nor can prejudgment review be presumed as the Court of Appeals did in this case. There's no parallel in this kind of situation to Rule 23C1 in the class action context where the rule invites the court to periodically reconsider the propriety of the class. Certainly a refusal of a consent decree is final as to the terms in that particular consent decree. Moreover, the notion of that the Court of Appeals touched upon of reconsideration of the consent decree in this case by the district court is meaningless in cases such as this one and such as the City of Alexandria case, which we cite in our brief, in which the district courts premised their refusal to enter the decree on their view that the decree itself has unlawful provisions and has no basis in fact, because there's no admission of liability on the part of the defendants. Even in a case where the court premises its refusal to enter the decree on more equitable kinds of considerations rather than legal, reconsideration the possibility that that order may be reconsidered at some point by the district court is not an appropriate basis for denying appealability. For example, in the case of Santana against Colazzo, a case that began in the district court of Puerto Rico and that ultimately wound up in the First Circuit Court of Appeals, index number 79-1531, the private plaintiffs and the Justice Department, as interveners on their side, submitted entered into three successive consent decrees with their adversaries, who were the authorities in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico responsible for the juvenile justice system. On each occasion, the first two occasions, the district court asked the parties to make certain modifications in the consent decree. The parties returned to the table, made modifications, and in each instance, the Court of Appeals rejected that consent decree. So even where the court ostensibly is not basing its rejection on a view of the scope of Title VII, this notion of reconsideration is not the boon that one would guess from the Court of Appeals' opinion.
Mr. Dalton, I take it that under your argument and that of your colleague, that the denial of the consent decree would be appealable by either party.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Or both.
Yes.
Does that cause you any problem?
No.
Both be taking the same position?
There may be difficulties, as indeed there was in this case, where no one wants in this case what happened was that the plaintiffs sought to appeal the denial of the consent decree and the responded defendants wanted to take no position on that in the Court of Appeals because they felt they were not in an adversary posture. Courts have tried various means of dealing with that problem. Some courts have invited the U.S. attorney to file a brief. Others have appointed counsel for purposes of the appeal to take the other side.
I would suppose that in some cases it might be the other side that would be most eager to have the consent decree entered.
Indeed. As this court said in Weber, there are certain often business reasons why employers very much want to enter into consent decrees.
Is there any reason why the parties could not abide all the terms of a consent decree if they were in the posture Mr. Justice White suggested, to abide those conditions voluntarily, even if a district judge would not accept the decree?
Well, it is certainly true that parties can enter into private settlements of lawsuits, and in any time parties are in
most time they do private litigation.
Indeed. And it is certainly true that when parties come to the point where they are willing to agree to terms of a settlement, they're much more inclined to abide by them voluntarily than not. However, the Justice Department routinely enters into consent decrees because they are enforceable by, among other sanctions, contempt, and because in the event of changed circumstances, it's often much more useful to put the question of whether or not the agreement should be modified or indeed even dissolved to an impartial judicial tribunal rather than to the parties. So while it is certainly possible that parties can enter into a private agreement, consent decree is, in the judgment of the government, a much more useful device all around from the standpoint of all the parties in the court. I'd like to touch upon briefly, Mr. Chief Justice, your question about which way the evils of piecemeal adjudication cut. I agree with my brother that the general notion that interlocutory appeals slow down the trial process is not in this context terribly useful, since what the parties are trying to do in a consent decree is to end the litigation. It's true, as Mr. Justice White points out, that the same can be said of a summary judgment motion. But what's left after a summary judgment motion, even if the denial is upheld on appeal, are only those issues to which there is a legitimate dispute, so that even though there may be a trial afterward, it's a very truncated trial, and it's not the same kind of full trial on the merits. And moreover, there are other independent reasons why this court unanimously concluded, I think correctly, that a refusal to enter summary judgment motion is not appealable, and those factors are not present here. Moreover, I don't think that the floodgate of litigation feared by the Court of Appeals is an appropriate or is on balance a reasonable fear when we're talking about refusals to enter consent decrees. To the extent that other reasonable alternative decrees are available, it seems to me it's in the party's perceived interest to search out and reach for those agreements. The very factors that led the parties to enter a settlement in the first place that Mr. Williams outlined, and the desire to avoid the expense and delay of litigation, would lead them to reach other reasonable agreements. The kinds of cases that would result in an appeal are precisely like those at bar, where the court's refusal to grant the or to enter the decree is based upon a misapprehension of the scope of a statute or of the requirements of the law. If there are no further questions.
Very well, Mr. Dalton. Mr.
Wickham. Chief Justice Berger, may it please the court. I'd like to suggest that that counsel left there another very good reason to avoid piecemeal litigation. And I think that the two opinions filed in the Fourth Circuit bear this out. That is that they're interfering with all the process of the trial court. And I think the reading of the two opinions in the Fourth Circuit shows exactly the type of jungle that we're getting ourselves into by permitting appeals of the nature that stand before this court.
What is held up by the district court's action except proceeding with the trial? Is that what you're referring to, that the trial cannot proceed in the district court now?
Well, that's correct, but it's also the views expressed by the majority and the dissenting opinions concerning what the trial court did hold. Did he hold conclusively that the plaintiffs had no case on the merits, or did he hold his actions were a collateral order, and so forth and so on? It just shows you where the appellate court should not be in an order of this type. The dissenting opinion went on to say that the trial judge abused his discretion, and so forth and so on. Went into the merits of the case and stated what they thought were the merits of this case. And I think that this whole case illustrates that that this type of order should be should not be appealed until it becomes final.
At some point, would you comment on whether your client wishes to withdraw, and if so, whether you may withdraw, or whether you're bound by some contractual consideration?
Well, Your Honor, after 28 months had passed from the time the trial court had this case until it got back, we did file a motion requesting a pretrial conference for the purpose of setting a trial date, and that, in that motion we stated that we now withdrew consent to the proposed decree.
Did you state that you do withdraw consent?
Yes, sir.
And did you ask for leave of the court to withdraw your consent specifically?
We went to the pretrial conference, and a trial date was set for this case.
The answer then is no.
No further order was entered, or no further mention was made of the respondent's motion to withdraw its consent.
Well, then I take it the answer to my question is that you made no formal motion to the court for leave to withdraw your consent.
We did not make any formal motion, except in the motion to ask for pretrial conference and a set of trial date.
In that motion, although it wasn't a motion to withdraw your consent, did you allege a right to withdraw or take the position you had a right to withdraw by reason of changed circumstances, or you just changed your mind about
We took actually no position.
I see.
Your Honor, we feel that that changed circumstances would be a consideration for the trial court if we'd made a formal motion to withdraw our consent. It would be in the nature of a Rule 60B motion. In effect, the consent decree could be entered, and then it would be a 60B motion.
I see. It'd be in a motion, a post-decree motion, but we would still have the problem here of whether the decree denial of the refusal to enter the decree was the refusal to enter an injunction.
So that really has nothing to do with why we're here today, as I see it, John.
Mr. Wickham, was a request for the setting of a trial date made before or after the Court of Appeals decided the case?
It was made after the Court of Appeals decided the case. We made no request at all when this case was appealed from the trial court. And then some 28 months later, it finally got back to the trial court, and at that time we made a request for a pretrial.
What jurisdiction would the district court have after a notice of appeal was filed?
Well, I don't think it would have any jurisdiction at that time.
Once the notice of appeal had been filed, the district court could not address itself to the question whether you had the authority.
That is correct.
The power to withdraw your consent.
That is correct.
Was that considered by the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals did not know we had withdrawn our consent. Our consent was not withdrawn until after the Court of Appeals, after the mandate issued, and it returned to the district court, Your Honor.
Mr. Wickham, I don't understand. If the Court of Appeals is correct in holding the order was not appealable, I don't know why a notice of appeal would deprive the district court of jurisdiction, because the notice of appeal would be a nullity.
Well, the district court granted a stay of these proceedings pending the petition for cert in this case, Your Honor.
But in the interim, between the time the district court acted initially and the time the Court of Appeals acted, There was no jurisdiction in the district court.
That's correct. No, sir.
Well, isn't that the issue we're called upon to decide today?
Well,
the appeal
I guess
was improper.
Well, theoretically, that would be if there was no
if
jurisdiction.
If it's an improper appeal, then the appeal didn't have any effect on the district court.
Well, then theoretically, the district court would have jurisdiction, but hardly would a district court take assert such jurisdiction pending the decision of the Fourth Circuit. Right.
You won't know that for some little time yet, will you?
That's correct.
But if the district court was deprived of jurisdiction, and in fact the order, then it must be because there was a right to appeal. And if it retained jurisdiction, it must be because the appeal was improper and it just chose to await the outcome of the Court of Appeals decision.
That's correct. But we did not make any decision to withdraw our consent until after the Court of Appeals had handed down its mandate, John. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make, is that, though I don't think it's very material to really what we've got to get at here, insofar as whether or not the Fourth Circuit has applied the proper test laid down by Coopers and Librand and by Gardner to see whether or not this order was indeed appealable under either Section 1291 or 1292A1.
If you didn't withdraw your consent, wouldn't the agreement that you entered into be enforceable as a private contract?
Well, we take that position that is one aspect of withdrawal of consent is a contractual relationship, and if we violated the remedy a suit for damages or what. The law is not clear on that subject at all, as far as we could find, Your Honor. But we contend here that these so-called Weber-type rights that the petitioners claim they have lost by this denial of appeal are, after all, private rights. It's a voluntary Weber-type right was made between the union and the company. And that same right could be agreed upon between the parties. In this case, could be dismissed, agreed with prejudice, and the plaintiffs would lose none of their rights, or so-called Weber-type rights.
Well, they could, in fact, sue you on the contract, I think.
That's certainly a possibility, Your Honor.
Well, I suppose the contract has a clause in it whereby your clients agree to the entry of a consent decree.
Well, Justice Powell asked what the provisions of the consent decree were. The main provisions were.
All I want to know
we
is about the one provision. Didn't you agree to the entry of a consent decree?
We indeed agreed to the entry of a consent decree. That's correct.
And so that is part of your contractual obligation.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that part of the obligation, because of Rule 23, can be negated by the trial judge if he refuses to approve it, I suppose.
Well, the only part that could be negated, it seems to me, we can still enter into a private agreement, like as someone pointed out a little while ago, many cases are settled, agreed, and the cases are dismissed. So the only thing that's really be lacking here, and so far as the plaintiffs are concerned, would be a contempt proceeding if the respondents had indeed violated the agreement.
But if you enter into a 25-paragraph settlement agreement, and one of the paragraphs says we will enter a consent decree, and the district court rejects the consent decree, that doesn't necessarily void the other 24 paragraphs of the agreement that you've entered into voluntarily.
It doesn't necessarily do so unless one of the parties would insist upon consent decrees in order to be protected by contempt proceedings for a violation.
Well, I take it the government suggests that it wouldn't enter into any settlements except in connection with a consent decree.
I heard that suggestion, but this is a private action case. This is not the government, or it's not the EEOC or any government agency in this case, you know. So what I think the considerations are a little different. There's no absolutely nothing wrong with us entering into a contract and having the suit dismissed.
Is the agreement in the record?
Yes, sir.
It isn't in the printed record, is it?
It's in the joint appendix. You'll find it starting on page 26A, huh?
Oh, I see. All right. I have looked for that. I didn't find it. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
That's just the consent decree on...
Well, that is the agreement. Is that what you asked for?
It really isn't the agreement.
No.
Well, that's all we have.
There's no separate agreement to...
No separate agreement, no, sir. I'm sorry. It's no separate agreement. We presented this proposed consent decree jointly at the last pretrial conference before trial.
And all of you moved for its adoption.
And we moved for its adoption
in there
at that time.
So that there really is no separate contract?
No separate agreement, no, sir.
So there would be nothing, if the judge refuses to enter the decree, the motions are just denied, and there is no obligation on anybody's part from there on?
It's no
of any kind.
It's no obligation on anybody's part, that's correct, but it's also nothing to prevent the parties from negotiating a different type of
agreement. Well, I know, but that hasn't been done.
That has not been done.
Was there an oral agreement? I take it what you're saying is there's no written agreement.
Well, we agreed to propose the consent decree found in the appendix to the here before Justice White. It's hard for me to really say that we have agreed because everybody was looking toward a consent decree. At least the plaintiffs were looking toward a consent decree. And they appealed the refusal to enter that order.
All three of you moved the court to enter the decree in any event.
Yeah, that's correct.
At least file memos in...
And then the court asked us to file memos in support of that decree.
Are the motions in the printed record? But I suppose they're in the record filed here.
That's correct. Well, if I'm not mistaken, it was an oral motion made at the final pretrial conference. The decree was presented to the court at the final pretrial conference.
And every party moved for it.
And every party moved at that time.
That must have been by agreement, by at least.
That's correct.
Agreement.
Was that by oral motion or by
written? That was by oral motion. We requested the court to enter this proposed decree at the final pretrial conference. I don't think you'll find a formal motion on that.
Is it correct, Mr. Wickham, to say that the consent decree contained the settlement agreement of the parties?
That's correct, sir.
And you wish to have the court approve it?
The district court, yes, sir.
Yes, yes.
Yes, sir. That's correct. It seems clear that this is not a final order under 1291 for the court did make a collateral determination, and that it's also equally clear that it's not a final order under 1291 because the order did not conclusively determine the claims for injunctive relief. And also it's clear that it's not final under 1291 because the petitioners can have an effective review of this order prior to and after final judgment. Now the same test seems to apply as laid down by Gardner for the refusal of the injunction relief.
Well, the proposed decree, the first paragraph, is that your client agrees that and a permanent injunction enter against them enjoining discrimination. And then in paragraph 3, provides for further injunctive relief, doesn't it?
Well, I think that
if you didn't live up to this decree, which would contain an injunction, you would be subject to contempt.
No question about that. You know. But it's our position that under Rule 1292A1, the test is whether or not these petitioners would suffer irreparable injury.
Right.
And if not, this type of injunctive relief is not such that is covered by the provisions of 1292A1. And it's very clear that that they have effective review. Number one, they, as you pointed out, they could ask for a preliminary injunction. They could have asked for that either before or after the refusal of the consent decree. That would certainly be appealable, refusal of that.
But normally when three people go into a court together to get a consent decree, it's not normal for one side to also ask for a preliminary injunction, is it? Is that the usual procedure?
I don't think it is usual procedure, but
so,
it shows that if you don't ask for a preliminary injunction, you must not feel that you have any irreparable injury to protect or to lose, so to speak. All I'm saying to you, Justice Marshall, is that under the test laid down in Gardner, that is an avenue open to the petitioners.
Yeah, I know, but you have to consider Gardner along with General Electric and Marvell, too.
Yes, sir.
And you have to consider them together.
And that's and certainly after final judgment, it's reviewable and effectively reviewable. Because if after trial the merits, the petitioners got more than the consent decree gave them, they certainly wouldn't be harmed. And if they got less, they could argue to the Court of Appeals that the facts entitled them to more. Title them exactly the same relief that the consent decree gave them, or even more than that. So they got effective review in this case. And finally, it's very clear that...
they're not objecting to the review. They're objecting to the result of the review.
Well, I'm saying if they have effective review, it's not a final order within the meaning of Section 1292A2, Justice Marshall. That's what I'm saying. And as to the fact that the court, district court, has or has not conclusively passed on the sufficiency of the claim, the court itself, the district court itself, started out and says, the plaintiffs have included a statement of facts in their brief in support of the proposed consent decree. For this purpose only, we accept these facts to be true. Now, with that statement, it's very clear that the court below, the district court below, did not conclusively find against the plaintiff. Now, if you look at the plaintiff's brief and the statement of facts in that brief, you'll see a lot more facts in there. A lot more facts, but they didn't present those facts to the court below. Now, you read those facts, and the respondents are very bad people. The effects of discrimination are still present everywhere. Those facts could have been presented to the trial court. Why they weren't, I don't know. But it shows that the district court did not pass on the sufficiency of, of their claims for injunctive relief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leavitt.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court, the reason the unions didn't make a formal motion to withdraw the consent was because it obviously wasn't necessary. The district court judge had refused to enter the consent decree.
Well, the union did not want to undermine the consent decree. Why would they make him?
Well, I'm talking, Your Honor, with respect when the case was remanded from the Fourth Circuit back to the district court judge. And then at the time that a pretrial conference was requested by the respondents, in that motion requesting a pretrial conference, the respondents stated that they withdrew their consent. They said nothing more except to say that they withdrew their consent. And at some time during the discussion between the court and counsel, the question was raised by one of the justices, were any formal grounds for withdrawal of consent set out? And I felt that it would be wise to...
They did not withdraw it. They said they would. In support of this motion, the defendants assert that they do not now consent to the entry of the proposed decree.
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
That means that the consent...
doesn't mean they're withdrawing it.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor...
The word withdraw is withdraw. They don't say that word.
Well, they do say, Your Honor, that they no longer consent, and I would submit to you that that's the same thing as withdrawing your consent.
Well, don't you need to file a motion?
Well, this was in a motion, but...
But this was a motion to ask for a pretrial conference.
Yes, sir.
That's what the motion is.
Yes, sir.
This isn't a motion to withdraw.
Well, it's a statement.
This isn't a motion to withdraw consent.
Well, Your Honor, the reason that...
And they say that this will be presented to the court at the pretrial conference.
There was no
That's
need.
What this says.
There was no need for a motion, Your Honor. The reason there wasn't a need for a formal motion to withdraw consent is because the district court judge had refused to enter the consent decree, so it was unnecessary to move him to do what he had already done.
And it was unnecessary to withdraw the consent.
Well, we wanted to make it a matter of record that the consent didn't exist.
But you didn't sign this, Mr. Wickham signed.
No, I signed it, Your Honor, I believe. It's page 67. 68A.
Yeah, down the bottom.
We did sign it, Your Honor. The unions did sign that. And we joined in that motion. But we felt, at least it was our position, that no formal withdrawal was necessary for those reasons.
Well, there never was a... Why did you call about withdrawing consent? Actually, you filed a motion, didn't you? Or you made an oral motion to enter the decree?
Well, at the time that the consent decree was proposed to the district court, there were supporting memoranda filed by the parties in support of the entry of the decree. Yes, sir.
But there was an oral motion, was there?
Well, it was, I believe it was when we presented it to the district court, we stated that we had a consent decree form, and I believe counsel wrote the district court a letter indicating that a consent decree would be forthcoming to the court. That the parties had were proposing to the court.
Well, you really, what you're really saying, you withdraw. You're interested in withdrawing your motion that the consent decree be entered.
Well, the two things occurred in such.
Because your motion was denied.
Such distant points of time, Your Honor. That's the time that the consent decree was presented. And the time that it went up, and the appeal time and the remand back was a couple of years. And of course, one of the things I wanted to mention was that the evils of piecemeal litigation certainly involved the appellate court getting involved in the trial process. Now, counsel for the petitioners distinguished the court's decision in Switzerland Cheese on the grounds that that was just a denial of motion for summary judgment, that there were material issues of fact. But I submit to you that we may have and do have basically the same thing here. If you look at the proposed consent decree, you'll see recitations in there where it's recited that the district court judge has reviewed the extensive discovery, and there was extensive discovery in this case. There were numerous depositions and extensive written interrogatories and production of documents. And it recites that the district court has reviewed the discovery in this case. So the district court, in denying entry of a consent decree, may very well have done so for principles and on standards which would be quite similar in denying a motion for summary judgment. And in that respect...
Did he give his reasons? Weren't his reasons legal reasons rather than the reasons you now describe?
I think that the reasons that he gave would very well encompass precisely what I'm presenting to you now, that he felt that it was improper for several reasons that he stated, but there's no question that he did review the record, that he did review the extensive discovery involved in the case. And for the appellate court to take that prerogative away from him when he may feel that there's a material issue of fact, and I think it's apparent that he did feel that.
But that goes to the merits of whether he acted properly in refusing to enter the decree, it seems to me.
Yes, Your Honor, but the point is that the appellate court would have to get involved in the trial process, and the appellate court obviously didn't go through the discovery.
Anytime you review a complicated matter, you have to look at the record.
But I don't think the appellate court reviewed the discovery in this case. And that's the point that we're trying to make, is that the appellate court did not review the discovery in this case the way the district court judge did. And that's why the appellate court would not properly get involved in the trial process here.
Let me ask you one other question about your point that 2 years went by after you made your motion and so that you didn't think it was necessary to let change circumstances. If the court should hold that the order was appealable and send it back to the Court of Appeals, and if the Court of Appeals should hold that the district court committed error in refusing to enter the decree, I suppose it would have the power to reverse and say the decree should have been entered, and therefore it would have been necessary to allege some kind of post-decree events in order to get out of the bargain.
Well, Your Honor...
But I suppose the review will take place as of the date that the district judge acted. And he either committed error on that date or he acted properly, one of the two.
I don't think that's necessarily so, Your Honor, because we can't ignore the terms of the proposed consent decree. And right at the outset of the proposed consent decree, the parties state that they want to avoid the time and expense of litigation. And perhaps even more than the expense of litigation in this case is the time. After all, the union has a collective bargaining agreement to administer and the company has a business to run. And when these parties entered into this proposed consent decree, it was with the anticipation it would be entered within a reasonable period of time. And it may very well, from the union's point of view as a collective bargaining contract administrator, result in utter chaos. Time may be very, very much more important than expense here.
Well,
so
again,
to limit
I think
it,
that goes to the merits of whether the district judge should be affirmed or reversed rather than to whether anything's appealable.
It also, Your Honor, goes very much to the merits of the proposed decree itself because the parties weren't getting what they bargained for. If we're going to talk about it in terms of a bargain, the parties are not getting what they bargained for and what they expressly bargained for right at the outset of the proposed decree.
The consent decree on its merits.
I'm saying that
the one that you agreed to.
The one that we agreed to, we would have been happy with if it had been promptly entered. But we anticipated.
Right now, you're not quarreling with it at all. With the merits of it?
What we're saying now
you
is.
You signed it.
Yes, we did. There's no question about that.
And
yes, we did.
You don't want to go behind that now, do you?
We have withdrawn our consent to it. We feel that we have a basic right to do so.
Well, show me where you withdrew.
We withdrew it when we stated in the motion to the...
That you wanted to withdraw it.
That we no longer consented.
That's right. And you wanted that to be discussed at the pretrial conference. Was it discussed?
There was no need to discuss it.
Well, why did you ask to do it if you didn't want
Because
it?
We wanted to make it a matter of record that our consent no longer existed on that document. We didn't feel that we needed to set forth formal grounds or make a motion to have it withdrawn because the judge had already refused to enter it. And we felt it wasn't necessary under the circumstances to do it.
Well, how do we stand now? Are you with the consent decree or not?
No, we don't consent to the decree.
You're against it now.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that you... That doesn't mean that you necessarily would have had the right to withdraw your consent. You simply said you wanted to withdraw it if legally permissible.
That's correct.
Well, really, none of this goes to the issues before us, which is the appealability of the denial of the entry of the decree. Is that correct?
I think it does, because I think that if there is
what
no...
What happened 2 years later is really not... It hardly bears on that issue, does it?
But there, if there is, I think it does, Your Honor. If there is no existing consent decree,
but there was at the time that it was appealed.
But if there isn't one now,
appealed.
If there isn't one now, it's an exercise in futility.
So your argument is really that the case has become moot.
Absolutely, absolutely, it has become moot. There is no case of controversy. It's our position.
Mr. Williams, do you have anything further?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, just a few minutes. Your Honor, we do not believe that the case is moot. The case is moot only if the denial of the proposed consent decree is not appealable. But that is the very question that we have been trying to seek review. Your Honor, one of the vices which...
I don't quite get that.
The consent decree...
Suppose the consent decree had said that until this case becomes final, either party may withdraw from it. Suppose it said that, and while the case was on appeal, one of the parties withdraws.
But that would be an entirely different matter, Your Honor.
I don't know why it's any different. The submission is that... either party was free to withdraw and that one of them has withdrawn. That's the submission.
Well, that's the submission, Your Honor, but there's no basis in fact, we believe, to support
that. What do you
that.
Disagree with in that submission?
Well, we believe that whether or not one can withdraw from a proposed consent decree would depend upon elements of basic contract law as well upon the principles set forth under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Well, where do you find the agreement that the consent decree be entered?
Well, Your Honor, we think that's manifested by the conduct of the parties, and we think that's manifested by their written signature to the agreement that was being moved for the court to accept. But, Your Honor, one of the things that I want to point out with respect to allowing a district court to make a legal determination as to what is allowable or not allowable without giving the power of review with respect to that determination is that, in effect, it does affect the parties' agreement to come to terms even out of court. Were the parties in this case to try to enter into an agreement that would basically achieve the same things as this proposed consent decree, then the parties would find that with respect to third parties, there would be a question as to the legality of what they were doing because of noncompliance with Rule 23E. Two, they would find that the opinion of the district court could be used as a basis to collaterally attack the validity of that out-of-court agreement, which they were then trying to voluntarily comply with. Your Honor, we think that a consent decree is needed in addition to any type of agreement that the parties might reach voluntarily in a case like this, in part because of the need, as this court found in United States Steelworkers of America versus Weber, to decide the rights of third parties. Secondly, we think that it is needed because of the need for enforcement with respect to those kinds of mandatory things that the parties are supposed to do or not to do.
The Weber case didn't involve any consent decree. That was simply an agreement between the employer and the labor union.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it did decide the rights of third parties with respect to the validity of that agreement. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Before you sit down, maybe it's impatient, but I did want to clear up one thing about the procedure. The proposed decree purports, as I understand it, to get rid of all damage for all members of the class. Did the procedure that was contemplated involve notice to the class?
Yes, it did involve some notice, but there's a question as to whether or not those provisions are adequate, Your Honor. But we don't think that that would affect the parties' agreement, the parties' ability to settle the case as such. But thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in